this is Lisa Schmeiser, host of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. And with me, my lovely and charming co-host, Philip Michaels.
You've stolen my bit.
Honey, we're married. We share everything.
That's true. I guess you get 50% claim on all my bits.
We have been married for more than 10 years. It's community property at this point.
Exactly.
Thank you, California. Mm-hmm.
So I guess you'll be doing Progressive Red Skull in this episode.
No, I think we should give the people what they want.
Okay.
And that's you.
All right.
As Progressive Red Skull. So, Philip, we have what is a semi-special episode of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies today, because we have just one trailer to talk about, and the only reason we're talking about that trailer is because we're committed to the premise of the podcast, which is to say we review movies based solely on a 90-second trailer.
Right.
What we'd really like to talk about before the Academy Awards for this year, we want to bring you into our conversational wormhole, namely which best original song nominations from the 1980s hold up really well on 30 years revisiting.
So shall we talk about the genesis of this entire discussion?
That's
a pun, ladies and gentlemen. Because
there we go. Yes, please do, Phil. Fill in everybody.
My lovely wife and I were having sushi one night at a local sushi establishment
without the child.
Yes.
Very exciting.
I don't know what soft hits of the 80s station that they had on.
But the nice people who run our favorite sushi place had a soft 80s rock soundtrack going on.
Yeah.
And we were actually kind of stopped in our tracks.
Because it was the song Against All Odds, sung by Mr. Phil Collins, former Genesis frontman.
And I said, this song is better than it has any right to be.
Yeah.
And I'm almost embarrassed to admit...
Take a Look at Me Now is the name of the song.
I love that song, though. Yeah. It's ridiculous, because you shouldn't. Nothing about that song on its face works. And yet, I think if you're of a certain age, you hear that song, you're like, oh, yes, this is cinematic and sweeping.
And as you say, that plunged us into a cinematic and Wikipedia wormhole from whence we have only now emerged, only to take you screaming, plunging into that hole.
To drag you back into the wormhole with us.
Drag me back into hell, we're going to say.
It's like the end of the movie Carrie, except the arm sticking out of the grave is ours, and we are dragging you back down into it, into a world where we're going to debate which is the better soundtrack of 1980, Fame or 9 to 5.
Ironically, no original songs in Carrie, so your metaphor breaks down.
Oh, you know, it does. But Carrie was also from the 70s, too, so it was structurally unsound to begin with. Speaking of structurally unsound, let's go through the formalities before we get to the big soundtrack discussion.
Exactly.
We saw a trailer from Mom and Dad with Selma Blair and Nick Cage, both of whom clearly have mortgages to pay.
Well, Nick Cage has castle mortgages to pay. Those are bigger than ordinary mortgages.
I feel like the lesson here is, if you're an actor, don't buy castles, because sooner or later you end up doing movies like this to pay for them. And the entire premise of Mom and Dad is to fulfill the paranoid fantasies of anybody under the age of 15, which is that your parents are out to get you.
I'm going to interrupt you there. Uh-huh. If you've looked at Nicolas Cage's body of work over the last two decades.
I try not to look at Nicolas Cage body or otherwise.
Yeah, I'm going to say that this is not anywhere close to the the most horrific thing that he's done. Yeah, still.
So here's the thing, is we can discuss there's horrific in the body of an overall, in the context of an overall body of horrific crap, and then there's something that can be stand on its own as something truly horrific.
Yes.
And I would argue that, you know, fine, this rings both bells.
So yeah, this is the horror comedy genre, a genre that I don't really.
The thing is, though, you don't like horror movies.
I do not care for horror movies at all.
And if we were actual critics, what we would do is we would try to check our own preferences at the door and assess this on the merits of its creative execution, its premise, so on and so forth. Fortunately, we're podcasters and unbound by constraints like quality, so we can just blurt out our opinion, and my opinion is I fail to see how this is any different from the teensploitation movies of the 90s, where it was Katie Holmes and Jennifer Love Hewitt all paranoid because adults were out to get them.
Well, it's like that one of Jon Stewart's rare cinematic forays, where all the teachers become murderous creepazoids.
Yeah.
Only this time it's the parents, and I guess that's more black comedy and daring. It's written and directed by the guy who gave us the Crank movies. Not Christmas with the Cranks. That would be a departure.
So you said the Crank movies, and for one brief hopeful moment, I was like, maybe it's about a gentleman who has a Ford Model T, and all of the chase scenes have him cranking the engine before.
I would love to see actually Jason Statham in a movie where he has to crank up his car before doing automotive stunts. I don't think he would agree to do that.
So I have to say, he's good at what he does.
You know, Jason Statham or the guy who does the Crank movies?
Jason Statham. Okay. Like, hooray for being you're the best Jason Statham you can be. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on having fully occupied that niche, Jason Statham. We wish you all the best in your continued career of Crank movies.
Yes.
And or whatever else it is
and you choose. Cranks and Transporters and
automotive
Italian Jobs. And
your genre of automotive masculinity.
Yeah.
You know, truly. It's actually a mystery as to why he's not dominating a Transformers franchise, because I feel like that's kind of a natural next step for him.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe Mark Wahlberg can donate a couple of roles to him.
Vin Diesel gets all his gigs,
I
bet.
Oh, man. Yeah. So we watched the preview for that, and
Mom and Dad. We're back on Mom and Dad. It does not look very good.
I do enjoy the appropriation of the phrase, they brought you into this world, they can take you out, because that is something I think every parent screams at one point in their life.
Yeah, so apparently parents are seized by some sort of zombie flesh-eating mania. And
so here's what I'm curious about. Uh-huh. And I realize you're getting back into the Persian insurance company territory. Uh-huh. So does this mania extend to adoptive parents? What about step-parents? Is it different if you've had reproductive technology? What if you were a surrogate and nobody knows about it? Are you also seized with mania because you've been biologically altered by the act of giving birth? Does the virus's activation depend on knowing that your DNA has been successfully transmitted to another generation? So are there marriages that are going to be imperiled when, like, the mom goes crazy and the dad does not, and he realizes that he's not the father of his own kids?
I feel that I'm about to give away a major, like,
is it nature or nurture,
plot twist in this movie.
Uh-huh.
But the trailer just telegraphs it so blatantly that if you see the trailer for Mom and Dad, you're going to figure this out about 5 minutes into the picture. The parents of Nicolas Cage come to visit, and I assume that they're also going to be driven mad by the murderous mania.
Yeah. So. Unless, of course, this film is a broadside against Generation X, because it seems like most of the killer parents are Gen X parents. And there is another major plot hole in the movie, as far as I'm concerned, because we're slackers.
Yeah.
Why would we bother getting off of the couch or being authentic or whatever it is that our generation does and go kill young people?
Yeah.
Seems like too much work. Why wouldn't we kill the boomers? They have more resources.
The millennials would just hire a task rabbit. Am I right?
Womp, womp. Yeah. So again, I want to find out, is the urge to kill offspring a nature or nurture thing? How does reproductive technology help it or not? Like, or, oh my God, Phil, what if you had, like, a tragedy? Are you only then, like, mildly like, hurdy as opposed to homicidal?
I feel that the 30 seconds that you've just explained your concerns is more thought than the makers of Mom and Dad put into Mom and Dad.
It's like my concerns about the Persian insurance policy. Mm-hmm. My concerns there still have not been addressed.
You know, you should really hire yourself out to Hollywood, like, weird, high-premise Hollywood movies. Where it's Lisa Schmeiser has questions, and then you go in and you ask questions, and it's like asking Orson Welles, but who else was in the room to hear him say Rosebud? And then Orson Welles turns ghost white and realizes his movie is ruined. Spoiler alert for Citizen Kane, by the way.
I would like that.
Yeah.
If I could just make movie executives turn ghost white and realize that their lives have been a lie.
Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh. I'm now filled with a renewed sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Go see Mom and Dad is what I guess we're saying now.
No. But again, if you do see this movie later and they do have any throwaway lines about or like a fun cuckolding joke, let me know, because I'm sure that that's going to be played for laughs in this, the horror comedy genre. Anyway, we're going to move on to one of our favorite discussions, which is to say taking a group of things and assessing them using nothing more than our own highly subjective criteria.
Right.
And in this case, what we're going to do is take a look at the Academy Award for Best Original Song nominees from 1980 through 1989. Why the 80s, you say? Because we now have 30 years of critical distance.
Yes.
And for the front of the 80s anyway, the back 3 years are still squeaking in. But the point is 9 to 5 was 38 flipping years ago.
Yes.
So we can talk about that now.
Yes. So
and we can agree that 9 to 5 was robbed because fame should not have won.
Well, let's start with 1980.
Yes.
And
your 53rd Academy Awards.
Yeah, and we won't have the discussion about when the 80s actually start and the 70s end. If it has an 8 in the decade.
That's what we're doing.
For purposes of this
discussion.
So cool your complaints, pedants. Mm-hmm. So your nominees that year. 9 to 5 with 9 to 5.
Yes, Dolly Parton, like living angel, walking on this planet, gave us that song.
Two nominees from Fame, both Fame and Out Here on My Own. Honeysuckle Rose, a movie probably no one remembers, but you know this song. It's On the Road Again. It's Willie Nelson.
Yep.
And finally, The Competition. Another movie probably very few people remember. With a song called People Alone, which is so obscure that there is not even a link to it on the Wikipedia page.
And do you remember when Amy Irving was quite the hot dish?
Sure.
Yeah. There we go.
Well, yeah, I guess that was her movie.
That was her movie with Richard Dreyfuss. That was
I think it's a movie about pianists.
Yes, it is. It's a movie about pianists.
Which should not be
confused. Pianists. People who play the piano.
Which should not be confused with The Pianist, starring... that guy.
Adrian Brody?
Yes, I was going
to
say...
The man who manhandles women on stage is that guy?
Yes, yeah. I was going to say Adam Driver, but that would be incorrect. They both have a similar facial structure, yeah. I think.
I think Adam Driver is, mass-wise, two of Adrian Brody's. Yes.
How many Adrian Brody's? Too many Adrian Brody's.
Oh, Bob. So, Philip, these five songs. Fame was your winner that year.
Fame, the title song. It's going to live forever. Irene Cara.
Yeah,
Written by Michael Gore.
Yeah.
And you've already sort of tipped the hand. 9 to 5 is clearly...
a better song.
Clearly a better song.
Yeah.
But, you know, Fame was the zeitgeist. The only reason I think of Fame is because of the TV series.
Yeah.
And the theme, which they reused in the theme series. And they interrupted it for that Debbie Allen monologue.
Yes.
Where she... You want fame, Leroy?
Well, fame costs.
And right here is where you start paying.
In sweat.
In sweat. Because...
she's
so
great.
Not to tell tales out of school. Our daughter is involved in an after-school program. One of many, so no one...
It's an enrichment program.
Yeah, and...
To make up for the parenting she's getting at home.
Yeah. There's a instructor there who very much is channeling that whole Debbie Allen...
Yeah.
Right here is where you start paying in sweat to the 6 and 7 year olds.
Yeah, it's not landing with them.
And it really... We don't want to be Leroy.
No.
We don't even want to be Coco.
No. Or Bruno.
Yes.
Or Doris.
No.
Or anybody in this.
No.
Yes.
So that was 1980. So
no, I feel like the subtle genius of using the tempo of the typewriters to underscore as the percussive beat of the song is just such a great little movie tie-in. And it doesn't date the song because you don't really realize it's there unless you listen for it. And it's just such a tight little ditty. Mm-hmm. And the lyrics are perfect and it's eminently singable. And this is actually a thing that I think works in movie soundtrack favor. If you have a song that people can bellow along to.
Yeah.
And it's not too complicated or challenging to sing. I feel like you've done a service to the soundtrack and the movie that way.
And it actually fits in with the movie, where it's not just shoehorned in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
as opposed to Out Here on My Own, which frankly is the and now Irene Cara's pipes number.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I mean, bleh. I mean, I think Fame is an okay movie. It's a series of vignettes. It actually has a very 1970s in New York feel to it.
It's basically, you could couple it up with Saturday Night Fever.
No, that's what you should do. That would be a perfect twofer.
Yeah.
Like, you put on your finest Danskin leotard and some Jordache jeans, and you roller skate into your living room, and...
well, then you're including Xanadu as, like, the third movie in that
Stop the Music.
Ooh, no.
It depends on your tolerance for pain.
Man, don't do that.
Oh my gosh, Ersatz Bimbo, Valerie Perrine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's 1980, done and dusted. Mm-hmm. I think we're in agreement there.
Yes.
So 1981, your nominees were One More Hour, which was from the movie Ragtime and was...
Mm-hmm. It's Randy Newman.
It's Randy Newman's
first... He sings what he sees.
It's his first Oscar nomination. Uh-huh. So if you want to blame the plague of Randy Newman nominated Oscar songs, blame it all on Milos Forman and Ragtime.
Mm-hmm.
The First Time It Happens from The Great Muppet Caper.
Mm-hmm.
For Your Eyes Only from For Your Eyes Only. Endless Love from?
Endless Love.
Endless Love. And finally, Arthur's Theme.
Mm-hmm.
From Arthur, from Yacht Rock mainstay Christopher Cross,
and that one did win that year.
And that was your winner.
Mm-hmm.
And a thousand people apparently worked on that song because it's
Burt Bacharach, Carol Bayer Sager, yeah. Christopher Cross, and Peter Allen. I like to imagine that Christopher Cross was like throwing rocks glasses at people screaming, I get credit! I bring it to life!
Yes.
You know, just drunk on his yacht somewhere. Mm-hmm. People are like, we got to get ourselves some of them glasses they use on submarines. They don't break when you throw them at people.
I'm going to say that this is a tough year.
So here's the I have to tip my hand. I don't care for Bond themes. I realize like it's a tradition and there are themes that stand out. Please do not start singing Goldfinger and the Stella Shirley Bassey. You know, like Duran Duran did like a View to a Kill.
Since you've asked that I won't do that. However, I will sing Thunderball.
Oh my God.
Coming on you like a thunderball.
Yeah, right. And that's and the thing is, they always have to shoehorn in the title of the song into mm-hmm. the theme.
Yeah,
and you know, Sheena Easton, lovely voice. Mm-hmm. This is a very 1981 year in a way.
Yeah.
I feel like it's if I were a voter, it'd be evenly split between Arthur's Theme and For Your Eyes Only. Endless Love feels like it was just airlifted in from a Lionel Richie B-side.
Yeah.
And they just put the words Endless Love in there because they're contractually obligated to. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Muppet... Look, I love the Muppet Caper.
Muppet Caper is a very underrated Muppet picture.
And Charles Grodin should have gotten more attention for how deftly he plays being sick with love for a puppet.
You might even call it a great Muppet Caper.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But,
No, Charles Grodin is the star of that movie. Make no mistake.
Very much so. But I don't even know that that's the best song in The Great Muppet Caper.
No.
I just think it's the song that they kind of rallied to.
It's really funny.
It is funny.
But the thing is I feel like the point of that song is it's a spectacle within the movie.
Yeah.
But it doesn't...
It's no Rainbow Connection.
No, it's no Moving Right Along, which is another really great... and it doesn't really fit my criteria, which is can you sing this along? Sing this in your own life? Or can you bring the cinema into your own... a good cinema song should be something where you sing it because you're like, oh my gosh, it speaks to me in my life. And at the same time, like you have this vaguely cinematic stirring in the back of your head and you feel more connected to the art or the art has inspired you to reframe your life in a different way.
Mm. So I'm going to give it to For Your Eyes Only. I would snatch the Oscar mm-hmm. out of Christopher Cross's hands.
I hope he throws a rocks glass at
you. Yes, as he's pouring himself another martini on his boat.
In a rocks glass?
I don't know.
Christopher Cross isn't a savage.
His follow-up song was like Sailing, was it mm-hmm. not? Just well, keeping with the brand.
There's also one called Think of Laura, which is about a dead girl named Laura.
Oh.
And it's...
No. Think about her, won't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. And then Ride Like the Wind, where he's apparently on a motorcycle.
Sure.
Jesus. I had no idea I knew four Christopher Cross songs. And
that is three more than Christopher Cross probably knows.
This podcast has just been a journey of self-discovery between career directions and Christopher Cross.
Yeah, wow. I think we're really making a breakthrough. Yeah. The end of our hour is almost done. So, yeah. No.
Let's move up to 1982. 1982. Where you have An Officer and a Gentleman's Up Where We Belong, written by Nietzsche and Buffy St. Marie.
It's Jack Nietzsche.
I like the idea that sweet Buffy St. Marie, who you know breastfed children live on Sesame Street in the 1970s, like mm-hmm. in the 80s, had one of those total yuppie jerkstore moments and turned to Nietzsche and then wrote the song.
Yes. Love lifts us up where we belong, where God is dead and man is Superman.
Uber mentions. Yes. No. Speaking of which, your Joe Cocker imitation there reminds me that of the two vocalists they could have chosen for that duet.
Uh-huh.
Those two, really?
I think Joe Cocker works.
Jennifer Warnes?
Does not work for
me. Yeah.
Although I believe we'll be hearing from her just a little bit later in the 1980s.
No, was she a backup singer who got a few...
I have no idea of her origin story or her provenance.
Was she bitten by a spider and then she began
Was she
singing?
Wandering by the studio one day and someone said, you there, can you stand up to Joe Cocker's lyrics?
She's like, of course I can.
Of course, who can't?
Who can't?
Yes. Okay. So that was one of the nominees.
So next up is...
And the winner.
Yeah, and the
spoiler
winner.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, the next next up is Best Friends, which is a Goldie Hawn, Burt
Reynolds
vehicle. I guess you're just blinded by the teeth and the charisma in that
one. How do you keep the music playing is the name of the song. And if
you don't. Moving right along. No. Rocky III, Eye of the Tiger. And then from Tootsie, it was It Might Be You, which I have no memory of whatsoever.
I do. Stephen Stills sang it. Maybe it's you I've been waiting for all my life. It was basically... Yeah. It was basically if you took the yacht rock of Christopher Cross and said, "Oh man, this is a bit. Yeah. This is the house is bumping now. We need to tone it down." get Stephen Stills on the phone.
Someone's pulse might have gotten above 70. Come on, quick!
They play the song when Dustin Hoffman goes to the farm with Jessica Lange, the farm in upstate New York, and he's dressed as Dorothy, and he's mooning over Jessica Lange, and Charles Durning is mooning over him. There is a lot of mooning while Stephen Stills sings. And it is one of those...
The 80s were a weird time.
It is a song that is literally, we need to stop talking, so let's have someone sing for a little bit.
And the last candidate is called If We Were in Love from the movie Yes, Giorgio.
Do you know the...
Pavarotti's only foray into acting.
Luciano. Someone looked at Luciano Pavarotti in 1982 and said...
You know what women want to see on camera?
Luciano Pavarotti.
Yeah, it's him. Yes.
Without Placido Domingo and the other guy.
Yeah.
So, yes. No, the Yes, Giorgio was a movie.
Yeah.
Oscar-nominated movie. But
so, Phil, let's admit it. There's just really two candidates here.
Yes.
They are Up Where We Belong and Eye of the Tiger. And of the two, which one lands with you now?
Eye of the Tiger.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's fueled 1,000 marathon training runs. Mm-hmm. People have run up the Philadelphia steps. Never mind that was in the first Rocky. They've run up to Eye of the Tiger because in their brains, it's a Rocky song. There you go. People have airboxed in their rooms. They've pounded the steering wheel of their cars.
Was it Starbucks that appropriated it for the commercial?
Roy. Yes, yeah. It was. Yeah. It was Starbucks that appropriated it. So yeah, Eye of the Tiger is, again, it's like 9 to 5 where it's an anthem that has people bring a little zhoosh into their own life. Whereas Up Where We Belong is the awkward first dance at a wedding.
Yeah. And
you know, the bride is wearing one of those dresses with giant leg of mutton sleeves, and she's got that weird headpiece that makes the V with the pearls in the middle of her forehead, and like she's got frosted eyeshadow on, and the groom is just beginning to grow out a mullet.
I remember we watched Officer and a Gentleman one evening.
So that takes us to another one of our great discussions, which is movies that have not earned their fantastic endings.
No.
Because that is a movie with a fantastic ending, but like leading up to it, you're like, really? This?
Yeah.
Really?
Way to go!
Oh, no, there's that iconic, he carries her out of the factory, and for a moment you can forget that the actors hated each other while working on that movie.
Yep.
And you're like, oh my gosh, this is really a great ending, and I feel very good about their chances. But, unearned ending. This song, like I said, awkward first dance at weddings.
Yes.
And let's move on to
1983.
Where Flashdance...
So congratulations on your mythical Oscar, Rocky III.
Yes. I don't know. We would give this award a cutesy name, but we're not going to pony up for a trophy, so why bother? 1983, Flashdance, incidentally, a movie soundtrack my parents threw out when they caught it in my possession.
Interesting. Yes. Whereas this is our different upbringing.
Uh-huh.
The first R-rated movie I saw in a theater.
Oh my gosh, no. My best friend's mom was taking her daughter, and she called my mom to ask if she could take me as well. And she did the whole pitch with, well, Lisa's a responsible kid, and I'd really like to share this with her, and it'd be a fun time. And my parents are like, no, because it shows gratuitous nudity, and the soundtrack, I believe, included a track called Seduce Me Tonight, and my parents are like, there will be no seducing in this house.
Not tonight, not tomorrow or ever.
Yes.
I was forced to, as a condition of being able to go to Flashdance, I had to cover my eyes during the scene in which there were boobs.
Did your mother enforce this?
This was enforced, yes. Hands over eyes, mister. But let me tell you, they don't check if the fingers slide open. No one's sitting there with a ruler. No one's running a pencil through your fingers to make sure that
they're
closed.
There is literally no better way to ensure that you're going to spend years of your life devoted to trying to see women's breasts on film than to make it seem like it's a big deal.
Yes.
Like, if you just been all casual, like, oh, here, look, this is flash dancing. She's flashing and she's dancing. It's a portmanteau.
Yes.
You know, by, like, age 15, you'd be like, meh, boobs, whatever.
Oddly enough, the scene where they're having dinner and she rams it, her foot in his crotch and brings him to pleasure, that was okay to
that
see.
That happened?
Yeah, that happens.
I've never seen Flashdance. My mom still hasn't let me.
You need to see, but you have to cover up when the boobs are on the screen, because I don't want you getting ideas.
Oh my gosh. So, 1983.
Anyhow, that was life in the Mike Pence household growing up, and mother won't let me see the breasts.
Oh my gosh. So. Mother wouldn't let me see the movie.
No.
So, Flashdance, What a Feeling.
And was Maniac.
And Maniac.
Two nominees for
yes.
Flashdance.
So two nominees for Flashdance. Yentl also had two nominees with Papa, Can You Hear Me? And The Way He Makes Me Feel. Mm. And then a Robert Duvall film.
Yentl, the Tootsie of its day. Yeah. Barbra Streisand dressed as a dude.
Yep.
Singing.
Yeah, so songs. That was the theme of the early 80s.
And Tender Mercies.
Which is a Robert Duvall vehicle that nobody remembers.
Robert Duvall remembers it because it got him his Oscar.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
No one remembers the song Over You.
No, no one remembers the music from Tender Mercies.
So here's the thing. Flashdance, What a Feeling, woman.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
It's not a great year, quite honestly.
No. And maybe there are women who listen to this while they're commuting, and they wish they still had like a magenta manicure, and they for a moment they're taken back to the 80s in their aerobics classes.
It's an upbeat song, and it's not totally shoehorned into the movie, so why not?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, 1984.
As you know, we both stand hard for this not winner, and we're going to start with another soundtrack that also got thrown out in the Schmeiser household. Oh. Footloose.
Oh yes,
because. Well, there's a soundtrack. There's a track on it called "Dancing in the Sheets," and my parents again were very, very opposed to anything that valorized premarital or extramarital sex in song.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the first time they saw it, they flipped over the listing and then read "Dancing in the Sheets." And they're like, "Nice try," and threw it out.
So, in a way, your parents were the John Lithgow character from Footloose.
They kind of were.
So, did you have to drive to the next county to listen to the Footloose soundtrack?
I guess Bruce Hornsby instead. I was living in Tidewater at the time. Oh. He was breaking big.
Sure.
No, Footloose had both Footloose and Let's Hear It for the Boy.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Footloose as the Kenny Loggins ditty. Let's Hear It for the Boy was sung by gospel singer Denise Williams. I'm screaming, but there's a gospel singer on the soundtrack. Did not cut any mustard in my
hustle. I'm going to argue that the best song in the Footloose soundtrack, I believe this was on the Footloose soundtrack, was not even nominated. That would be Holding Out for a Hero. Wasn't
that's Bonnie Tyler's Holding Out for Indeed.
That is the best song in the Ding Dang movie. So why wasn't that nominated?
I don't know. Everyone was living in a powder keg and giving off sparks, I guess, Phil.
Yeah.
Once upon a time.
Okay.
Also, Ghostbusters by Ghostbusters, from Ghostbusters with Ray Parker Jr., who was the genius responsible for both music and lyrics, was nominated.
And famously didn't even see the movie when he wrote the song. They just said, write us a song about busting ghosts. And he said,
is that a euphemism? No, don't tell me. Let the muse go.
Nope. Ray Parker Jr.'s on it.
Yeah.
I the muse has spoken to me.
Yep. The Woman in Red track, I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And then Against All Odds.
And the winner that year was The Woman in Red.
I Just Called to Say I Love You.
Mm-hmm.
Which honestly feels like it was sponsored by the Hallmark Channel.
Yes.
It is
Stevie Wonder's remix of Calendar Girl by Neil Sedaka.
Yeah, except without, there were no modern holidays turned into like Happy Administrative Assistance Day.
Mm-hmm.
There was no Grandparents Day.
Obviously.
No Veterans Day.
Obviously, the winner is Against All Odds.
Obviously.
And before we started recording this podcast, we watched the video.
Oh my God.
For Against All Odds.
I implore you. Please go to YouTube.
Yeah.
Search for Against All Odds. Don't stop until you find the video that was uploaded by the production coordinator for the video.
No, that was the actual video.
My point is it was uploaded by the production coordinator. And that was the actual video.
That aired on MTV and elsewhere.
And this video has everything. It has lasers. It has Phil Collins. in a pattern blazer singing against a backdrop of rain. It has really weird edits from the film that are meant to try to match up to the lyrics. It has Rachel Ward looking incredibly beautiful in that 1980s way.
It has the percussive violence of Jeff Bridges, where he's punching guys and being in time with the drum beats.
And being in a football game in time to the drum beats.
Yes, and I think you're leaving out the best part of the Against All Odds video.
Is when I audibly screamed upon hearing seeing James Woods?
No.
He looks so creepy,
it opens with a Aztec mask that morphs into Phil Collins' face.
Yeah, because there's just the really weird part of the video where the top half is the mask and the bottom half is Phil Collins' mouth, and because this is 1983 and we haven't invented special effects yet, it's really weird. You've got to watch this.
Also, I believe in the Oscar ceremony that year, the producers put the ixnay on Phil Collins actually performing his own song.
Because they didn't want people to know what he looked like.
Because he wasn't a big name enough.
Yeah, big enough name.
Although they let Ray Parker Jr. perform, but that was a monster hit.
Yeah.
So by that point.
So why do we think Against All Odds is such a good song?
I don't know. It's very emotive. It You know, it's an 80s song, but, you know, it's of its time, but it...
I just get the feeling that a lot of divorced men, like, would call their ex's answering machine and play that song.
And also, on it. You know, we mm-hmm. Phil Collins has become a subject of mockery for good reason. Mm-hmm. Because, you know...
He's a very skilled technician, though.
He's very skilled technically. I mean, you know, Susu mm-hmm. Studio is a very... And the whole no jacket required thing. And the transition of Genesis from this artsy-fartsy band into a...
Where Peter Gabriel's dancing around stage just like a sunflower again.
Yes,
to corporate rock.
We're cranking out the hits, and these are the songs that are going to be played at your next golf outing.
Yep.
I think he... did some pretty good tunes. Mm-hmm. I also liked his music for Buster, the movie that he made where he's a crook.
Yeah, Two Hearts.
Yeah.
And Groovy Kind. He did a remake of Groovy Kind of Love that
Which
I really like.
Which is
quite
good. Yeah. And this is of that genre. I think if you like, of the Phil Collins songs, mm-hmm. this is probably his best work.
Well, there we go. All right, so we're going to move on to
1985.
White Nights has two songs in contention. The first is Say You, Say Me by Lionel Richie. Mm-hmm. The second is Separate Lives, which was a duet between Marilyn Martin and Phil Collins, because Phil Collins peaked in the mid-80s, let's not forget. Back to the Future's The Power of Love, mm-hmm. as sung by Huey Lewis.
The world's greatest bar band.
Mm-hmm. A chorus lines, special written for the movie Surprise, Surprise.
Sung by Jim Nabors.
And then,
surprise, surprise, surprise. Hi, this is Jim Nabors. Mm-hmm. They cast me in a chorus line just to sing this song. They wrote it for the movie. And what then, I did for love.
No, that's not written for the movie. And then...
Dance 9 looks 3. Hee hee. Goodbye. Back to heaven with me. Rest in peace, Jim Nabors.
And then Miss Celia's Blues from The Color Purple.
Yeah, well,
that is a thing that happened.
No, well, the thing I remember is A Color Purple got nominated for, like, they got 11, 12, 13 nominations, not for Whoopi Goldberg, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
But it won 0.
Mm-hmm.
No wins, not even a technical win, not even a
Here's
the prize for getting the most nominations.
I feel like the voters just nominated themselves on being okay with a black film.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, they were like, well, that's progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not. So there you go. I really feel like that was the case where they just congratulated themselves. They're like, we're in Reagan's America now. You should just be grateful we have the movie. Mm-hmm. So... speaking of which, we're back to White Nights. Say You, Say Me was the winner in 1985. Was that the right choice, Mr. Michaels?
It was not the right choice. The right choice would have been Separate Lives.
Yes.
Again.
Another song that you play to your ex on the answering machine when you've had one too many margaritas on a Friday night, TJ Fridays.
Why do we keep bringing up Criss Cross in this song?
Criss Cross screaming and throwing glass from the back.
Not the hip-hop group Criss Cross, no. The yacht rocker Criss Cross. No,
they were children, Phil. They wouldn't have been drinking. They had good upbringings.
The White Nights, the Separate Lives song actually fits in with the movie.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a nice, angry song. Like, you don't often get songs that do bitterness really well.
Mm-hmm.
And that one does, like, it takes you on an emotional journey.
Yeah. Whereas Say You, Say Me...
Mm-hmm.
is just
1980s garbage.
Run through the lyrics sometimes, folks. Sit down and really give those lyrics a think that Lionel Richie is singing out of his mouth hole.
Say it together naturally.
Yeah. I had a dream.
He had an awesome dream.
Of people in the park playing games in the dark, and what they played was a masquerade. So what does that mean,
you
Lionel
realize,
Richie?
Of course, that is basically the first color to the first cousin of the MacArthur Park lyrics, where someone left a cake out in the rain, and it took so long to bake it, and they'll never have that recipe again.
So what I apparently learned from Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast, where they interviewed the lyricist of that song.
And he's like, it's just a cake, man. It's not heroin. It's not a metaphor for
anything. No, he actually was having a picnic out in MacArthur Park, and mm-hmm. the rain came and washed the thing away, and that he was breaking up with his girlfriend, and it was very...
It was basically like, my lady's never making me that cake again because she's no longer my lady.
Exactly. And people have been coming up, what does the song mean, man? And
thanks for helping me revisit the breakup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
anyway...
I don't think that Lionel Richie actually had an awesome dream about people in the park playing games in the dark, and what they played was a masquerade.
This is a man who is also...
I think he was dancing on the ceiling, rather.
Yes, exactly. All night long. All night. All night long, Phil. Mm. So who knows what could happen. Maybe you do have the hallucinations about people in the park playing games in the dark, and what they play is a masquerade. I'm not ruling anything out. It was the 80s. It was weird.
Anyhow, but Separate Lives is the better song.
And I'd like to actually hear a remake.
Yeah.
I would. I'd like to hear a remake in this day and age. Mm-hmm. All right. But moving on to 1986. We are whipping through the 80s, as our poor podcast listeners can attest. So Top Gun's Take My Breath Away, as sung by Berlin and overlaying one of the most uncomfortable love scenes committed to cinema in that year.
Is it where Goose kisses Maverick?
No, that one was natural. That felt right. Somewhere Out There by American Tail, Don't You Dare Start Singing It. Glory of Love from Karate Kid Part 2.
The only reason I want to go through the list, rest of the nominees.
And then you can sing. Mm-hmm. All right. Then you can. Glory of Love from Karate Kid 2, as sung by Peter Cetera and given to us by David Foster. Mm-hmm. Little Shop of Horrors gave us Mean Green Mother from Outer Space.
Written for the movie.
Yep. And, from the movie That's Life, Life in a Looking Glass, Henry Mancini.
Had no idea that That's Life was a movie, mm-hmm. let alone an Oscar-nominated one. Yeah. Couldn't tell you.
The problem is that came out around the same time that David Lee Roth did his solo career and sang That's Life. So I had a horrible moment of confusion. I'm like, David Lee Roth? But it's a
Blake Edwards movie.
Starring Julie Andrews.
Well, yes. No wonder I drove it from my mind.
Yeah, there you go.
Because, Blake Edwards when it isn't a Pink Panther running around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. So anyway, we're back to recap Take My Breath Away, Somewhere Out There, Glory of Love, Mean Green Mother from Outer Space, and Life in a Looking Glass.
So, An American Tale.
Uh-huh.
The thing I remember about this video, and we did not watch this, mm-hmm. is it actually begins with the little mouse uh-huh. singing the song
yeah.
in his little mouse voice. Somewhere out there.
And then it transitions to Ronstadt and James Ingram.
And James Ingram comes and sexes that up. Yeah. So instead of having a sad mouse, you've got sexy man singing singing a prayer.
To Linda Ronstadt, because she comes in and she's got her sweet Linda Ronstadt voice too, and it's very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't win.
No, it didn't.
And it shouldn't have won.
No.
Top Gun's Take My Breath Away versus The Glory of Love.
I'm going to go, Take My Breath Away probably should have won, and it did.
Yeah.
I don't really care for Glory of Love from The Karate Kid Part 2.
Yeah. It's a David Foster song, so it's got all the David Foster 1980s hallmarks, and then Peter Cetera made a video where he danced around in black pajamas. It was a confusing time.
Yeah, and you make him sound like he joined the Viet Cong. The man in the black pajamas, dude, a worthy adversary.
We'll
a
fight worthy in adversary. A I'll put you in cages.
I think my objection with the Karate Kid song is literally you could strip it out of the movie and the movie would just be fine.
Yeah.
Whereas Top Gun, the music was very much part of the Top Gun experience.
And again, think about how creepy that love scene would have been if it had just been done without any music.
And
it's just been like weird, awkward sounds.
What if it had been just Val Kilmer humming in the background? humming like
punctuated with the occasional
The Wild Blue Yonder. Like in The Right Stuff.
Punctuated by the occasional tooth chop. Chop.
And I'm saying all this as if my dark confession, I've never actually seen Top Gun.
Oh, God.
That is one of those, that there are occasionally movies that are so popular and become so popular, mm-hmm. I just say, well, the rest of America has seen it, so I don't need to. So that's Home Alone.
My very first
Top
date
Gun,
where I was allowed
and,
to go.
My very, Pretty Woman.
My very first date where I was allowed to go out with a boy. I went to see Top Gun.
Huh?
And so there's a lot about that movie that's indelibly etched on my memory.
Did you fly into the danger zone?
Philip, I was 14. Come on.
Well, the danger zone can mean different things to different people.
It probably did to that poor young man. I had braces.
Speaking of which, why was Danger Zone not nominated? Did Kenny Loggins offend people with his Footloose shenanigans?
Maybe. Someone just really wanted Henry Mancini to get a nomination that year. I don't mm-hmm. know. But... yeah, because Danger Zone is actually a song that I see I have seen a lot of middle-aged people like floor their car, floor their gas pedal on their car, and it's totally subconscious when they do it. But mm-hmm. you know, it's got that whole thing going on. So yeah, all
yeah.
Right.
So fine, Berlin.
Congratulations, Academy! You got that one right.
Yeah.
All right, 1987. I've had the time of my life.
From Dirty Dancing. No one puts Baby in a corner.
Yep. Beverly Hills Cop 2's Shakedown.
This was a Bob Seger yeah. song.
Surprise.
Shake down, take down. Your
here is your new lawsuit as yes. served up by Bob Seger.
Yeah.
You're
busted.
Cry Freedom from the movie Cry Freedom.
Couldn't tell you the song.
If, to save your life,
if,
yeah.
If you sang it to me seconds before we recorded, I could not recreate it.
Yeah. Which is, well, and the thing is Cry Freedom, I believe, isn't this the song that's got Peter Gabriel's Biko in it?
No, because they actually made a...
they made a Stephen Biko movie. Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a live version of his song was released to promote the film. Yeah. So that explains why I was all yeah. confused. Okay.
Yeah.
So we've got those first three. Princess Bride's Storybook Love.
Which I like because Mark Knopfler sang it. You just visibly twinged.
Yes, I did.
Oh, why? Why
do we not have screen and screen podcasting?
Well, I suppose now is the time we can bust out our working theory about Dire Straits. that every man alive
loves
Dire Straits and cannot envision anyone not loving Dire Straits. And every woman always gets a mixtape with Dire Straits on there.
And sighs and says,
another goddamn Dire Straits mixtape song.
Do you know how many times Romeo and Juliet has been used on mixtapes in America, Phil?
Yes.
Do you know how many times? Like, they were mixtapes... And if they weren't, and you had to pay royalties for it, Mark Knopfler would probably own Madagascar, like with the royalties. It's just a lot.
Yes.
The dice were loaded from the start.
So, Mark Knopfler. Some of us are a fan. Some of us are not.
And that's okay.
Some of
Differing
us.
Opinions yeah. make this a lively exchange
of
ideas.
Some of us have XX chromosomes and hate Dire Straits.
This is true.
So
sometimes yeah. you're the windshield and sometimes you're the bug.
Okay. And there's one other song that we haven't talked about.
Yes. Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now.
From Mannequin.
Which is another video we watched tonight
yes,
to prep for this podcast. And oh my God.
I can't
believe Grace Slick stayed sober through the 80s when she had to do schlock like this.
Because as we were watching the Phil Collins Against All Odds video, Lisa was enthralled at how just clips from the movie that make no sense are being
and
thrown
trying,
in here.
And they were trying to match them up to the lyrics, which made it even more confusing
and
because
I said,
they're
Lisa,
clearly editing things out of order.
Lisa, the master of the genre, is Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now from Mannequin. And I said,
let's prove your thesis.
And I encourage you to
back
go to
onto
YouTube.
YouTube with you to look for the official Jefferson Starship, Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now. That video has everything.
Yes, it has Grace Slick pretending to be a mannequin.
Mm-hmm. It's got Andrew McCarthy looking like he regrets everything, really, mm-hmm. in that movie.
It's got clips from the movie. It's mm-hmm. got Meshach Taylor appearing in the video.
It's got the lead dude singer of Jefferson Starship.
Yes, with growing his hair out.
Oh, like, the mullet is horrible.
Like Grace Jones in Solidarity, or Grace Slick in Solidarity.
If it was Grace Jones, if it was Grace Jones,
it's a different song.
Then it'd be really cool, too. And then,
nothing's going to stop us now.
And the thing is this song is just so transcendently stupid.
It is so terrible.
It is like somebody went to a self-help seminar and listened to all the affirmations and then said, you know what, if I just take the nouns out of all of these sentences I've heard, string them together, and put them in a Mad Libs, then I have the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And that is basically what it is. And you have to remember, Mannequin is also a transcendently stupid movie.
It really is. It really is the worst telling of Pygmalion, in my estimation.
Yeah, and I would concur. There may be worse ones. You're welcome to let us know what they are on Twitter, so we can pass judgment on them, too. I'd like that.
Anyhow, fine. Dirty Dancing gets to keep its stupid trophy.
Because this was a terrible year.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. But anyway, yeah, my nemesis, Jennifer Warnes.
Yeah.
Well, she's not really my nemesis. I just don't get her career.
No.
Like, why? Why?
You! Can you sing with an Everly brother? Sure, I sang with Joe Cocker. Then come on into the studio!
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things... Well, so, one of my favorite recent documentaries was 20 Feet from Stardom.
Mm-hmm.
Which... And I'll digress into the Helter Skelter thing in a minute with that one. But what you see with 20 Feet from Stardom is you have a lot of backup singers who are very, very gifted vocalists, period. And it's just a series of circumstances that they've never had a chance to have a solo career, or else they're very gifted vocalists, but they don't have the desire, or they don't have the stage presence, or what have you. And every time I hear Jennifer Warnes sing either one of these Oscar-nominated / Oscar-winning songs, I'm like, was she a backup singer? I don't care enough to find out, but I always just wonder, is that how this happened? She's like reliable. She shows up at the studio. She's got a good voice. She can perform on demand. So they're like, fine, you'll do it. You know, you'll cost us less than Debbie Harry or whatever. And they go from there. I just, I don't get it. I freely admit this.
Yeah.
Also I hate this song mostly for its ubiquity, but, That is my cross to bear. So, moving on to 1988, where we go from 5 candidates in the field down to 3. But I would argue that Carly Simon's Let the River Run from Working Girl is basically 3 candidates all by itself.
Yes.
I
actually enjoy the years where they cannot find 5 nominees to fill a category.
Yeah. And you have Calling You from Baghdad Cafe. I challenge anyone to remember that song.
No.
And you also have Two Hearts, which is a Phil Collins song from Buster, movie that otherwise sank like a stone.
Phil Collins, who just is the muse of the 1980s Oscar. You know, everyone says Kenny Loggins is Mr. Soundtrack.
No,
but really,
Phil Collins.
And he's
kind of a sleeper.
And he would eventually win in the 1990s for the Tarzan movie.
Mm-hmm. So you know, he refined his craft in the 80s. And
he was the Randy Newman of his time.
Yeah.
So
that's basically it. So,
you know, why not Let the River Run?
So what I remember most about Let the River Run was it was basically the audition piece for every girl in show choir in the late 1980s.
It's, yes.
Yeah. And then because in high school choir, you almost always have like a ratio of 20 girls to one guy. Whenever they had the big recitals at the end of the year and you brought out the advanced chorus with its thousands of sopranos and 8 sullen altos and 3 tenor boys, you always had a performance of Let the River Run and then the sopranos elbowing each other in the throat to do the different solos. It was delightful.
Hmm. I like to think that this is another Ray Parker Jr. situation where Carly Simon was never shown Working Girl and had no idea what the movie was even about.
Oh,
and,
my friend, you have to see the video.
And just wrote a song, just
you
threw
some
lyrics together.
You have to see the video.
Because the lyrics are nonsense.
Yeah, you have to see the video because the video takes place on the Staten Island Ferry with Carly Simon and they had Joan Cusack dress up like the character again.
Uh-huh.
And Carly Simon is like life coaching her through the lyrics.
They must have had to have used a court order to get Carly Simon on Staten Island Ferry.
dangle the royalty check into, crap, you've trapped me on a boat. Well, I'm here. I might as well film.
Is this boat going to the Hamptons? Sure is, Carly. Get on board.
I mean, I thought she was more New England-y than
that. Yeah, she's more, is this going to Cape Cod there?
Yeah. Or Martha's Vineyard, one of those. Yeah. Yes. One of those places where the light is washed with the Atlantic
Ocean. Yep, sure thing. This is going to take you to James Taylor's house for a barbecue. Okay. Wait, this is going to Staten Island. God damn you!
Was the greatest hoax perpetrated on the American public in the 1980s. All right, so we're to our last year. Yes. Our last year in the 80s.
1989.
Indeed.
A number, another summer, sound of the distant drummer.
Nowhere near.
Funky drummer.
Yeah, nowhere near. Yeah, no. Oddly enough, Phil, nothing from Do the Right Thing made it into this.
Well, I've tipped my hand because, anyhow, let's say who the nominees were and who the winner
should have been. Chances are. The movie is called Chances Are.
I believe that's a Robert Downey Jr. vehicle.
And the song, after all, was Cher and Peter Cetera duetting each other. So,
of course, well.
That was something that someone who was high on a lot of cocaine clearly approved.
Okay.
Parenthood had I Love to See You Smile by Randy Newman.
I
remember nothing about that song.
I remember nothing about that song.
And I saw that movie several times.
Yeah, yeah.
So Shirley Valentine.
The Girl Who Used to Be Me, again. And, not a memorable song, because really, the deck is stacked here, because you have not one but two Little Mermaid nominees.
Yeah, it's also worth pointing out that Shirley Valentine is one of those films that does really well when you watch it on cable later.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this is relevant to me. This is a woman who ditches her life and starts over in Greece, and who among us has not dreamt of doing that? But it didn't land in the year that you had The Little Mermaid, because Macon and Ashman were unstoppable. And
well, this was the revival of Disney.
Yeah. This was the Little Mermaid was the opening shot across the bow there, mm-hmm. and they both Under the Sea and Kiss the Girl were nominated. And if you ask me, I think the right one, Under the Sea, won.
I agree with you among the nominees.
Yeah,
but come on, Fight the Power should have been nominated.
Well, absolutely,
and it really should have won. And
yeah, because Phil, you're bringing us into the corollary of our discussion. Mm-hmm. Which is that among a lot of these, the problem with this is sometimes the best movie soundtracks don't get anywhere near the awards.
That is true.
And the thing is you're absolutely right that Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, phenomenal soundtrack, Fight the Power should have won. Look at who votes in the Academy.
Oh, sure. Well, it didn't even get nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. But do you honestly think that the people who were voting in the Academy in the late 1980s watched that movie, much less like considered it in any sort of critical context or any sort of filmmaking context?
I don't. Yeah. The one reason why you would say, well, maybe it at least sneaks through for a nomination. Mm-hmm. Shaft.
Yeah.
Shaft won the Oscar for Best Song.
But this was the 70s, and you have to remember that in the 70s there was a big cultural movement going on. The 80s were conservative and reactionary, culturally speaking.
And man,
there was
that
a huge regression in the way people were portrayed in the movies all the way through the 80s. You had the revival of the magical Negro trope. You had a systematic stuffing back into the box of women where they were solely used as sex objects or plot complications. You had movies that valorized greed and put forth the premise that there was nobody more oppressed in America than straight white men.
Yeah.
So
I'm
the Right Thing was not going to work because it presented a nuanced and complex picture of a nuanced and complex social situation.
I'm just imagining an Oscar ceremony where you have Chuck D and Flavor Flav doing the Elvis was a hero to most to say Elvis was it and like scandalized Academy members like
Kirk Douglas is clutching at his bow tie.
Kirk Douglas would have loved it.
Yeah.
How dare you?
All right. Charlton Heston was
there. You go.
Yeah, there we go.
There you go.
Yeah. Also, I would have liked. Well, remember when 3-6 Mafia won for A Heart Out There for a Pimp?
Oh, yeah.
And the Academy was like, oh, my God, we can never let that happen again. So
nothing cool happens again ever on the show.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's pretty much it. You have to remember that the coolest stuff that was going on in the movies in the 1980s And the thing I'd argue is some of the best and most successful soundtracks of the 1980s were never going to get nominated because they were actually cleverly edited compilations of other artists' work, and that work wasn't written specifically for the movie. Cameron Crowe, for example, gave good soundtrack in the 1980s. John Hughes, whose movies I find tremendously problematic, and I feel like history has been far, far too kind to his body of work. John Hughes does give good soundtrack. I love his soundtracks. Hate his movies. And yes, I'm including Ferris Bueller in that. Love the soundtracks on that.
You can hate Ferris Bueller.
Sid and Nancy's soundtrack, for example, is a combination of original scores plus stuff from the Sex Pistols. And it's an insanely great soundtrack. None of this stuff was going to get nominated, though, because that's not how the rules work.
No, that's true.
So that's it. But yeah, I mean, there have to be movie soundtracks from the 80s that landed with you.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
You've put me on the spot.
I didn't mean to. I'm sorry.
Darn you. Yeah. Mostly scores.
Yeah.
I was more into scores than I was...
you're more high-minded than I am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course. So high-minded.
Yep.
Daddy Elfman, take me away!
Yeah, there you go.
No, I used to play the 1989 Batman soundtrack over and over again on cassette,
see,
ladies.
The 1989 soundtrack I played over and over again was actually from Say Anything.
Oh, well, sure.
And again, I have problems with Cameron Crowe movies, but the man knows how to edit and give a good soundtrack. And right. 1989's had Fishbone. It had Depeche Mode. It had Freiheit. It had Ann Wilson, who actually did a song for specifically for the movie. So it's kind of a travesty that didn't get nominated.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It had Red Hot Chili Peppers.
You can't get in the way of Shirley Valentine, Lisa.
No, I guess not.
Don't you remember the mobs of people pouring into the streets chanting, Shirley Valentine! Shirley Valentine! Shirley! Anyhow, it's a painful memory because I was trampled by a mob of Shirley heads.
They call themselves the Sherls, yes. Phil.
They called it the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
No, they would chant Sheryl Power. Sheryl Power, Sheryl Power.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyhow, that's a decade's worth of
songs we've opined on.
Of the Academy's hard work just pissed upon.
And all of this prompted by a night out for sushi, where we heard a Phil Collins song and said, we like this more than we should. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean that we're uncool. This means that we're having a discussion about soundtracks.
Thank God that we didn't hear the Lion King playing.
I have a really sweet... So, I've never seen that movie, believe it or not.
I have not either.
But because of the mechanics of the large Irish Catholic family from whence I come, several of my cousins had kids when that movie came out. And one of my fondest memories is actually of being stuck on the highway over Thanksgiving holiday one year with the Elton John song coming on the radio. And all of these little kids' sweet voices singing along unselfconsciously to Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Mm. And I still don't like the song. I like the memory of the little kids singing and being happy and excited that they heard a song they knew.
Well, there you go.
So, and I think that's actually one of the most potent things about movie soundtracks is it helps reinforce and amplify the feelings you have during a movie. And there's a lot to be said for the emotive power of music there.
I think so.
Yeah. One of these days we'll tackle trailer music. And how I can no longer listen to Delamitri's 1990s stuff without thinking about every 1990s trailer that was ever made.
Mm. We didn't discuss it on this podcast because I think watching the trailer broke you.
Yeah.
The new 50 Shades of Grey monstrosity.
Where they redo the NXS song?
Oh, yes. Where it's sung by, like, a breathy lady.
Oh, yeah. Well, because that's the thing. If it's not some child singing a song in a creepy, menacing fashion, it's a sad, breathy lady.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'd like to thank all of you who tuned in to listen to Phil and Lisa discuss the 1980s soundtracks. This is probably not what you tuned in for.
Yeah,
thank you anyway.
Thank you for listening to our off-brand podcast.
Well, no, we discussed a trailer, and we appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So, if you do listen to this podcast, and you've committed to this afterwards, please feel free to hit us up on Twitter. My Twitter handle is LSCHMEISER. We love to hear from our listeners.
My Twitter handle is Philip Michaels, and there's only one L in Philip.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one Philip.
Yep.
In your heart.
Yes, you'll be in my heart.
That's a
1999. So come back in 10 years when we assess that.
Yeah.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.